already have a load of some money.
Well, I have a list.
Good morning. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it is about February the 20th. And we're just moving right along. Today, we will really get into the depth of education. This is an education subcommittee, and we've been dealing with other things, but today we get into education. But first, we're going to finish up our report from our esteemed Doug Wilson. And so, Mr. Wilson, why don't you just go ahead?
Get a picture here. So, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, quickly, we have about 10 slides left. We'll go through them quickly. Just while I have, I'm talking here. So the chair did state that we're finally done with the licensing board. So we will start in with the education agencies this morning and tomorrow. Lindsay Capps and the agency heads and lead people on the programs will provide sort of an overview, and then we'll start off with the chief education office midweek this week, TSPC hopefully on Thursday and Monday, and then start the state school fund and Department of Education. We run those at the same time, and then finally ending up with HEC. Both HEC and ODE will be multi-week hearings on both of them, so they are extensive. So what's worse is that I'm stuck being the analyst for both those agencies, so you'll only see me from now on and not some younger, nicer looking faces. So, oops, it went back to the beginning. Interesting.
So what's the date again?
The sixth.
Sixth.
Oh, yes, thank you. So what we have left is post-secondary. We'll get here. So general, or just quickly, this is general fund and lottery funds, and where the post-secondary education budget is for current service
58,
level.
57 for us.
Oh, actually, is it 58, or is it?
That's 58.
58.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks.
I did get him back on track. the largest piece in this post-secondary is public university support, just under $700 million, followed by community college support at $570 million every 2 years. And you can see the other areas. Other public universities are Ag Extension, Experiment Station, Forest Research Lab, the specials, but it also includes the ballot measure 99 outdoor school, which is budgeted with the lottery funds at estimated at $44 million. The Oregon Health and Science University here is the, that $75.7 million is the programs, basically the medical school, what the state provides to medical school, nursing, and other activities up there. There is the debt service, and most of that $26.7 million is funding for the Knight Cancer Institute building that is under construction now. There's also, just so you know, there's another roughly $38 million in other funds limitation at OHSU from tobacco tax master settle or tobacco master settlement agreement funds, and that's funding some biotechnology and other things back around 2000 or soon after the turn of the century.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Wilson.
Good morning.
The public university debt, can you provide me or the committee amount of PERS obligation fund unfunded liability? I think it's community colleges.
Mr. Chair, I think your pension obligation bond.
Well, the unfunded liability.
Okay. Well, I'll try to get that information for you. The public university debt service here is the general fund for paying off bonds that were issued on behalf. Nothing to do directly with PERS.
Thank you.
But these are for buildings and such. Student assistant, most of that is the Oregon Opportunity Grant. They're at $167 million. It also includes $20 million for the Oregon Promise Program. And finally, the all other HEC. sliver there that is work, almost all workforce development related dollars. Most of that comes through as general fund, but there is roughly about $8.5 million of general fund resources in the workforce development area. This is just some sort of history of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. In 09-10, I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I think there were a large outlay in the first year with the hope that there would be more money coming in the second year. The binding was my recollection. And that also, of course, was at the height or depths, whatever the right adjective is for the Great Recession. So that's one reason you see such a drop there for a one-year period. It is finally getting back up to where it was at its peak in the first year of 09-11 biennium. In terms of what schools received the opportunity grant, you can see here that community colleges by a number, this is by recipients, not dollar amount, is larger than public universities. And then there is some funding that goes to what are referred to as independents, but are non-state entities, usually for private colleges. In terms of the history of the general support to public universities, this includes all general and lottery funds. You can see that it varies significantly. The other pattern here is that debt service or bonding, the state bonding or state bonds issued for or on behalf of the public universities for various dollars has been growing as a proportional share, significantly growing, in fact. But you also see here on this graph what happens when the state revenues are down. Higher education is one of those things that take a dip, probably more so than others. And part of that is because they have another revenue source, tuition, which they can go to when they have to. Of course, that always creates a whole set of other issues to address when that happens. In terms of public university students, you can see here that you have the FTE at the bottom. Those are full-time equivalents. I believe that's based on like 15 credits a quarter. And then on the top are the actual number of students. And while there are significantly higher amount of resident students than non-residents, non-residents play a very important role. And I'll give you a statistic in a minute for the University of Oregon, but they do play a significant role in generating revenue.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, Doug, and by resident and non-resident, you are only referring to whether they live on campus or not, not whether they are in-state or out-state?
These are in-state, out-state.
This is
in,
okay,
yes.
Thank you.
And this is history of tuition and fees based on 45 credits per year. You'll see significantly higher for non-resident. And that you see the bottom line there adjusted for inflation. So even under inflation, tuition has increased quite a bit for public universities, probably more so for the non-residents, but part of that is just the scale. The comment I want to make is the importance of out-of-state tuition. For the U of O in fiscal year 2016, their main sort of education and general fund account, the state appropriation represented about $65 million. In-state tuition was $104 million. And out-of-state tuition was over $280 million. So out-of-state tuition is a significant contributor, at least to U of O. It's probably highest there as a proportion than other public universities, but it's still significant in the others.
Do any of our other universities have a significant portion from out of state like U of O does, or is it mostly U of O?
Southern Oregon.
I would guess Southern Oregon probably does. I think they actually all have a significant amount. I'm not sure about the other regionals. I need to warn you, I'm relatively new to higher education or public universities, just picking it up in the last month. So
yeah, well,
some of the, I can't respond as quickly to those kinds of questions, but I will get back and check.
From Mr. Cannon a little later, and maybe he can answer those questions.
(Clears throat)
So the next graph, moving on to community colleges, same type of thing you saw at the public universities. Again, there's a growing, but a little less so in terms of the importance of debt service on the bonds issued on behalf of the community colleges. But there's also a similar sort of pattern to the ups and downs of funding. They, again, also have that other revenue source of tuition. And you can see that during the recession 10 or 8 years ago or so, that you see there was a significant downturn in the funding coming from the state. But at the same time, you had increasing number of students during that same period. So this shows you the students, shows that the number of students going to community colleges, and probably a little less so in public universities, are subject to economic forces. So when the economy's down, more people go to school.
Can't get a job, go to school.
Yes. So the bottom one is the FTE. Again, sort of a full-time equivalent number of students based on, I believe, again, it's 15 credits or something like that per quarter. And the top line are the unduplicated student count. You can see the importance or the preponderance of part-time students as a result between those two lines. And here, in terms of the student type, these are all, you can see the top line there is total FTE, student FTE, but you'll notice that the lower division, collegiate, those probably getting their associate degree or taking classes before they move on to public universities or some other university or college four-year setting. And then the certificates is the red line. The blue line with, I guess, green triangles are the developmental education. And then there's a classification of other students that don't fit into those definitions or that haven't been defined. So you'll see that also that the impact, again, of the economy there during the recession increased the number of students, and now it's fallen off again. And community college tuition, same type of pattern. In this case, there's not necessarily a resident or non-resident at most community colleges, if not all, that's true. And annual tuition is increased. Even after you adjust for inflation, it's increased quite a bit at community colleges, just like at public universities. And finally, just a sample again of issues, and this isn't meant to be all of them there, but you have to deal with the amount of support for community colleges and public universities, and therefore also the funding you have will likely affect what the level of tuition is. And I'm sure the both the community colleges and the public universities will be informing you of that. What might happen tuition if you don't get up to current service level or above what they're working for. We have a number of deferred maintenance needs on both community colleges and public universities. I know they've requested funding for that, as well as security. After the Umpqua Community College incident, there was a task force put together appointed by the governor on security issues at, I think it turned out to be all education facilities and not just community colleges and public universities. Performance-based distribution of the college or community college support fund. The public university support fund distribution has built in now some performance measures, you know, things like completion rates or number of diplomas or some measure of what one can call performance-based. Community colleges have yet to move that way. If they do, there, I think there was a little harder road hurdle to get over to get everyone on board on that. It's still out there being discussed. You have the Oregon Promise Program, which we will be putting about $3.5 million into for this biennium. It is running over budget, and that will also affect how much funding it needs for next biennium. And keep in mind, right now the current service level is only at $20 million, and the cost of that program fully rolled out will exceed $40 million most likely under the current pattern of student enrollment in it. I mentioned the reliance of out-of-state tuition on public universities. There's the availability of student financial aid. The Oregon Opportunity Grant has had some significant increases in the past biennium or two, but it still is, you know, only reaches a percentage, a relatively small percentage of the students that need financial aid. And finally, just another sample issue, you have ballot measure 99, the outdoor school implementation that actually runs through the Extension Service. That's where the funding goes, and they are the party responsible for setting it up and rolling it out statewide. It is scheduled to roll out in the first year of next biennium, and I think there's going to be quite a bit of work. If that was going to continue on that schedule, it would take a lot of work to get it rolled out at that time. So, Mr. Chair, that is the last of my slides, finally done. I just mentioned I was going to put something in on 40-40-20, but I do believe that Mr. Capps and his colleagues will discuss in at some depths where we stand on the 40-40-20.
Questions for Mr. Wilson, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I noticed on the slide, the slides dealing with revenues, and that the growing proportion of the revenues used for debt. And I'm just trying to understand, is that a reflection on diminishing support that we're doing overall for education, or is it more a reflection on the condition of facilities? I mean, I'm trying to understand, because that's growing pretty substantially, the amount of revenue that's going to debt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, I think it's partially a matter of we don't have enough general fund today. This is one of the reasons. And that one way we can help either community colleges or public universities is to issue debt for buildings on campus for other, you know, it's mainly infrastructure that's funded, and you pay that off over the years, usually 20-plus years. That's one reason. And there are deferred maintenance needs as well as building needs on all the campuses.
Mr. Chair, it just seems to me that, you know, I'm concerned about that trend, the revenue that's taken away from providing instruction in that, but that's why I asked the question, I guess.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. Wilson? Thank you very much. Now we can move to... We're going to start with Lindsay, or I guess so. Mr. Capps. Dr. Knorr, Mr. Cannon, and Mr. Mandel. Okay, Lindsay, you're on.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer. I would say I'm very excited to be here. We are all excited to be here to provide an overview of our seamless system of education. Each of the individuals here will introduce themselves and have others join us, but I'll be joined today by our Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Salam Noor, our Early Learning System Director, David Mandel, Youth Director, Development Director, Iris Bell, Higher Education Executive or Coordinating Commission Executive Director Ben Cannon, and TSPC Executive Director Monica Bean. These are all leaders of entities that under Senate Bill 215 were joined together under the auspices of the Chief Education Office in terms of coordinated cross-sector planning. So that's a key theme that we'll be talking about today. Throughout our presentation, we will share sort of current and future work that we are all engaged in alongside our education institutions, as well as communities, not only to improve educational outcomes across our seamless system of education, but certainly toward achieving the governor's goal of ensuring that every Oregon student graduates high school with a plan for his or her future. As you will hear in greater detail throughout our presentation, we also have a foundational commitment in our collective efforts to pursue educational equity and a vision to eradicate persistent gaps in achievement and opportunity.
Lindsay, what year was it that we went away from an elected superintendent and gave that job to the governor, who then appoints people? Assistant Superintendent, it's been about 4 years ago.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I believe it was in 2011.
2011.
And 1859.
2011, 6 years ago.
Just to remind people.
Yes. Yeah. Ratified at Champui in 18.
Time goes so fast when you're having fun. Okay.
Thank you for the question. So I'll just go over the order of our presentation today. We want to give you just a sense of our student context with data that we'll share from early learning through higher education and some of the calls to action that we see reflected as we look at that data and some of the gaps that we are trying to close in student outcomes. We'll talk a little bit about what binds us together as agencies in terms of our commitments and that guide our planning work. And that obviously is folded into a key role, the Chief Education Office. We'll talk a little bit about the Oregon equity lens and how that's applied in our work. And then I think consistent with the presentation that you've received from Mr. Wilson, we'll talk about some key priorities across the system that we think are particularly important in making progress around key student outcomes. And then we'll end with just a conversation about what we see as some opportunities and challenges facing the entire educational system that we look forward to engaging with you as the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. So with that, I will turn it over to David Mandel to talk a little bit about our children and families in the early learning system.
Mr. Mandel.
Co-Chair Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee, for the record, I am David Mandel, acting early learning system director. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about Oregon's education continuum and the place of early learning in it. While the children that we work with may be just learning their letters or even their first words or even taking their first steps, our goals are really the same as the rest of my colleagues that I'm sitting up here with today. Students graduating from high school, going on to earn a degree, a credential, and succeeding in the workplace. There are close to 250,000 children in Oregon who have not yet reached school age, about half of whom are born on Medicaid. As you can see from the slide, Oregon's youngest children reflect the growing diversity of our state. The early learning opportunities that these children are able to access are quite varied. About 19,000 children per year are able to access one of the programs that the early learning system administers, home visiting through Healthy Families Oregon, a therapeutic relief nursery designed to prevent child abuse and neglect and support families, a preschool from Head Start or Preschool Promise. But there are many more, over 100,000, who attend a child care or early learning program that is private or run by a nonprofit. And at the heart of this work are the 22,000 members of the early learning workforce who work with these children on a daily basis. So I just wanted to give you a sense of just the variety of these early learning settings that the early learning division works to support. With that, I'll hand it over to Salam.
Good morning, co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I too want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today with this distinguished panel and look forward to sharing some information and answering any questions that you may have. So David talked about the early learning students that the system serves. I'm going to share with you some numbers and some key features, if you will, of our K-12 system and the students that we serve in that system. We have over 576,000 students in our K-12 schools. They're taught by over 66,000 staff members in 347 schools, to be exact, in 197 school districts representing every corner of the state. Please note the demographic changes that we're experiencing as a state. We see a great change in the type of students that we serve, the type of families that access and engage our system, and that means that we have different needs. We have different opportunities, if you will, because those students bring a lot of assets to the system and to the schools as they engage and participate every day. But that also means that we have to change the way we deliver services and try and accommodate the interests, the needs, and the opportunities that present themselves. Just some highlights in terms of who those students are, and in addition to the demographics. Nearly 10% of our students are English learners. We have a high number of students that actually are designated as homeless, over 21,000. 13.29% of our students are eligible to access special education services, and they're an integral part of our system. A significant number, 51% of our students qualify for free and reduced price lunches.
And Dr. Knorr, what are the qualifications to get on free or reduced?
It's a federal criteria based on the number of students that actually are below the poverty threshold, the federally designated poverty threshold.
Do you know what that is right now?
Chairman Rohr-Knight, right off the top of my head, and I'd be happy to give that for you.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You bet. So, next slide, please. Yep. So as we think about those students and we think about the fact that our primary responsibility is to educate those students and make sure that they graduate on time, and most importantly that they are prepared to take on that next step in their life, whether they go directly to a college, to a university, to a private career school, or directly to the workforce. This slide is very emblematic, if you will, of some of the challenges that students face in our school system. So nearly 12,000 students do not graduate on time every year. And if this current trend continues, that means about 150,000 students that are now enrolled in our K-12 system will not graduate on time. And I say on time, but for a fact, many of those students don't graduate, period. They don't actually complete. But we know, based on a four-year graduation cohort, about 12,000 students do not graduate. A disproportionate number of those students are students of color, students that live in poverty, and predominantly males. We know that these students have their own individual stories and circumstances that may be preventing them from graduating. And we know, because our demographics are changing, and as you look at these student groups, they require different types of supports and interventions from our system. If we don't do anything, this trend is likely to continue. So we have an opportunity through this process to really impact the outcomes for those
Representative
students.
Parrish?
Thanks. Do you also cross-reference the dropout population against things like disability, they're on an IEP or 504, their TAG, because I'm really shocked at how many TAG kids I hear drop out. So do you have those numbers also, besides just kind of poor demographics, some of those other populations? Do you track it that way too?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, Representative Parrish, yes, we do have that data. So we are able to identify students that are not graduating, so those that are completing over a five-year period, so we can get that information for you if you would
great,
like.
Thank you.
Great, you bet. If I may continue, and related to your question, Representative Parrish, these are the students that are not graduating, and I want to remind the committee that the graduation rate and the dropout rate are not the inverse of each other, because the graduation rate is based on a four-year cohort, and the dropout rate is based on an annual enrollment data. But as you look at this data, it's very clear who is not completing high school in 4 years, and that makes it really clear who's not graduating in 4 years. So this breakdown compares our students of diverse backgrounds with their white student peers, and 23.4% of our white students do not graduate on time. And as you can look at these numbers, they're much greater than that. So we definitely have a gap, an opportunity gap, and a graduation gap. So a large percentage of those students are historically underserved and disproportionately affected by this situation. And this also reinforces the fact that our schools are diversifying, our communities are diversifying, and that requires a different response on our part. And as we talk about the Graduation Equity Fund, that fund specifically is really designed to address the needs of those students, to provide those additional supports and interventions that are specific to different student groups that need additional supports as they navigate our system and get them to graduate on time, similar to their peers.
And of those that don't graduate on time, I think I've seen numbers that about 80% of them don't graduate at all. Is it in that range? Yeah, okay.
So in terms of our state's chronic absenteeism rate, I think it's well known that we have one of the worst attendance rates in the country. And students that are disproportionately impacted, you see up here on the chart. So we have a lot of work to do, as Salaam talked about, in terms of how we address the needs of these populations in both culturally responsive ways and in holistic ways of supporting their attendance. We know from the work that the Chief Education Office did in our chronic absenteeism research that was released in May of 2016 that this is a very complex issue. It certainly begins with the types of supportive relationships that our children and students experience in schools, but it's also how do we, beyond education, provide the supports that families need that are often lacking and contribute to that attendance rate.
Yeah, isn't it true that for the vast number of students that have an absentee problem, that it's largely because the parents aren't making sure they get to school, pushing them to get to school?
Chair Smith Warner, I think that that's a factor in terms of where we're seeing success. It's where there is that family engagement to help address some of the family context issues. It may be a parent having a job or the ability of that parent to access childcare. There are issues along those lines. I think there's also an important factor here, which is how are we providing relevant coursework and engaging classes for a lot of these students, especially as we think about ways in which, especially for our lower income students, that we're connecting education to career opportunities. That's another critical piece. We've seen increases in high school graduation rates just around those districts that have done more to provide career technical education, for example. So I think there are context issues in terms of where our students are coming from, but it's also what are we doing in the schools to make sure that we're engaging those students effectively.
But, you know, some parents just don't see it as a high priority. My wife, when she was in high school, she had a little baby sister, and her mother would have her stay home, take care of the baby sister instead of going to high school many days. So it was a matter of her mother thought it was a greater priority for her to be home taking care of her baby sister than going to school.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner committee. Just wanted to add, if you look at and I think you may have seen this before, if you look at the pattern of chronic absenteeism across the grades, you see a really strong U pattern where it's highest in kindergarten, first and second grade, and then decreases and then sort of increases as kids get older towards high school. So I just brought that up because I think it goes to some of that, you know, I think particularly for that high rate, particularly in those younger grades, some of those challenges around work and family, you know, are, you know, obviously contributing factors to that.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Unfortunately, just tall enough to sort of peer over the monitor. All of you. That's okay. I'm very glad to be here with my colleagues and under the leadership of our Chief Education Office presenting with as a system which we really endeavor to operate as. I'm going to move into the higher education space and talk a little bit about data related to higher education enrollment and completion as we finish this section of the presentation off. So these are our 17 community colleges. The size of the circle corresponds roughly to the enrollment, and the location of the circle corresponds roughly to their location in the state of Oregon. Now, likewise, our 7 public universities with their about 130,000 students. These numbers do include the non-resident out-of-state students who comprise a growing portion of the total. In addition, we have almost 3,000 students enrolled at OHSU, another 6,300, and in fact, that's a partial number, 6,300 enrolled at private degree-granting post-secondary institutions. Those would be independent colleges and universities, including the one across the street, Willamette University, and over 13,000 students enrolled at private career schools. These are typically certificate-granting institutions that train Oregonians for the workforce. But, of course, we're interested in not just enrollment, but completion, graduation. And so this is the data from 2016, the number of awards provided by each of those sectors that I've just described, a total of over 46,000 degrees and certificates earned at Oregon public institutions. And the result of those degrees and certificates, of course, are Oregonians who are better prepared to enter the workforce and contribute to their communities and families. That also signifies progress towards our state's ambitious goals for educational attainment. The 40-40-20 goal, which is depicted here in the right-hand bar of 40% of Oregonians earning a bachelor's or advanced degree, another 40% earning an associate's degree or undergraduate certificate. These may be 1 year, they may be 2 year. They may be shorter term even than that, but that is the so-called middle 40. And then the final 20% having at least completed high school or its equivalent through GED or other high school equivalency.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Cannon, thank you all for being here. Could you back up one slide and maybe even two? So I just was, I love footnotes because I always read them. And I just noticed that on the total numbers of the kind of not public schools, I mean, that's, you only have information from half of them. And particularly the slide before this, the idea that there's only 6,000 people enrolled in all of the other private degree granting post-secondary. I mean, I can think of 6,000 people's worth just from Willamette and UP and a couple others. So is that, that's just troubling that the is that a poor, like, is that a lack of compliance by then on returning numbers to the HEC, or?
Representative Smith-Warner, members of the committee, so those are, as you've noted, under footnotes 3 and 4, those are partial figures. We have varying degrees of authority for data reporting relative to our private institutions. Through rulemaking over the last several years, the HEC actually has increased the requirements that those institutions are subject to. But the institutions in footnote 3, those private degree-granting post-secondary institutions, the generally independent colleges and universities, are essentially exempt from state oversight. And so while we've worked on data sharing agreements with them and those that are participating, for example, in the state reciprocity, interstate reciprocity agreement relative to distance education, come under some greater authority of the HECs, These are partial figures in part because our authority is only partial to collect them. We don't get nearly the same level of detail as we do for the public institutions. That 6,300, though, and I'll have to follow up to be certain, but I think it does describe the majority of enrollment at that sector, but not, as you've said, not the entirety.
Thank you. So, and if I may just follow up, so it sounds like basically we mostly have to use carrots because we don't have a lot of sticks to use with those, organizations, institutions.
Yes, I think that's essentially right.
Okay, thank you.
Well, the private colleges, though, have to maintain their certification, and usually at least once every 10 years there's a visitation to the campus, and they check them for library. They check all the kinds of things that indicate that they're certificated degree-granting and successful institution. I've spent 15 years on the board of Warner Pacific College, and I know they had these visitations every few years and had to jump through some hoops.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, it is true that institutions, degree-granting institutions in Oregon that qualify and participate for the federal financial aid program are accredited, and that's the results in the visitations you described. That accreditation, along with other factors, contributes to their exemption under state law from HEC regulatory oversight. Mm-hmm. So there, we in effect, the law in Oregon relies on accreditation, regional accreditation, along with sort of financial financial well-being, a history of financial well-being, to effectively exempt our best known private institutions, the Willamette's, Pacific, Linfield, Reed, et cetera, from state authority for the most part. And there are some very modest exceptions to that.
Yeah, it's called the Northwest Accreditation, something that covers the whole Pacific Northwest area.
With your permission, co-chairs, 40-40-20 is described in the bar on the right, and our progress towards that ambitious goal is described on the left-hand side. This is essentially a survey, a snapshot of Oregon adults as of 2015. The goal, you'll recall, the 40-40-20 goal, is explicitly in statute a goal for Oregon's adult population. So the way the numbers on the left-hand side are derived are by surveying Oregon's adult population. And we look to the Census Bureau for its annual population survey updates in order to establish sort of our progress towards 40-40-20. You'll see the gaps, and they are greatest around that middle 40, where we estimate that about 17% of Oregon adults have that middle 40 certificate or credential, and the goal, of course, is 40. We've added a green bar here, that 18%. Those represent students who have enrolled in college at some point in their life. They've reported that they've attended college but haven't completed a degree or certificate, and that, of course, represents some real opportunity, we think, towards moving towards that 40-40-20 goal. Of course, then the blue at the bottom, that 10% or are Oregon adults who have not completed high school or its equivalent.
So if we get those 10 to go back and get their GED, then they could move up a notch.
Co-Chairman Monroe, that is correct. They would, upon completion of the GED, they would be counted in that red high school diploma or its alternative, which is the way it's described in the 40-40-20 statute. The progress towards 40-40-20 varies, of course, by demographics and by region, by race, ethnicity, and by income level. Here we've depicted it by race, ethnicity, and you'll see the very significant gaps against that goal for some of the populations with whom we're on whom the equity lens points particularly. And so this slide helps to illustrate the significant lengths that we have to go as a state, particularly with respect to our American Indian, Alaskan Native, Black or African American, Hispanic, Latino, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander populations, where those gaps are quite great.
38% of Latinos don't have a high school equivalent.
Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, correct. And I should note again, just remind the subcommittee, this snapshot is for all adults in the state of Oregon. So if we there's a very different way of looking at 40-40-20, which is to look at young Oregonians who are coming up through our K-12 system and perhaps take a snapshot of their educational attainment rates as of the age 24 or 25. We have that data, too. I'll present that to you when our agency presents its budget. It represents it describes a somewhat more optimistic view for some of these populations and not others. In fact, as a whole, Oregon is further behind 40-40-20 when we look at just the young rising Oregonians, but the Hispanic Latino group, for example, the numbers are better.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And that was really my question. I was curious about comparing where we're at with younger people today versus that. And if we're going to get that information later, I appreciate that.
Good.
Okay, so we've covered some of the key student data across the system, and now I just want to shift our attention to the role of the Chief Education Office. We will have the opportunity to be back here on Wednesday and I believe Thursday to give you a full presentation on the agency, but we just want to mention up front that obviously through an act of the legislature in 2015, what had previously been the Oregon Education Investment Board was repurposed and recalibrated to really focus on this agency, not as a directing agency as had been the past, and certainly the chief education officer who had directional authority over all the agency directors, but really to transition and being a policy and research entity P through 20 and focused on convening and coordination. I think one of the key findings of that work group was the opportunity we had in Oregon really to not only foster collaboration between agencies that are providing governance, oversight, and coordination of their respective sectors, but also to be thinking about how we're working on key system issues with a number of different players in the system, not the least of which are educational institutions and other organizations and community partners. So I'll talk more about that on Wednesday, but with respect to our specific role as redefined under Senate Bill 215, we really are looking to build this seamless system through most importantly cross agency planning. Much of what you will hear subsequently today in terms of presentations around key areas of work have been organized through cross-agency teams that have met and worked together not only in identifying opportunities for legislative or budget priorities for this legislature to consider, but longer-term goals and synergies of work across agencies. We have a role to play in bringing together not only our research team within the agency to be thinking about not only system issues that need to be addressed, but helping to drive best practices and evidence-based policy. We are working to develop a statewide longitudinal data system that will help us to link and analyze student data across the system. And we have a core focus around equity and building cultural competency within the system, which was a direct charge of this legislature. Another piece is really around cross-sector engagement, and so we have opportunities to work most importantly around the transition that we see between the early learning system and the K-12 system and between the K-12 system and the higher education system. There are a number of issues and layers of issues in which we have a specific focus in collaboration and partnership with our education agencies. And the last piece is we are entrusted with working with the legislature and the governor to both establish and monitor our statewide goals. One of the things that was not resolved in the Senate Bill 215 work group was at one point in time we had achievement compacts at all levels of the system which identified key statewide goals. Those compacts went away. We as agencies still look at, you know, ready for kindergarten and third grade on track and sixth grade attendance and all the rest as important benchmarks for our work. But at this time, we don't have formal goals established beyond those that have been set by the governing bodies of each sector. In terms of our
Representative Wisnett.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Chief Education Officer, when you come, it's not for today, but I think I have a role and a mission here to serve the co-chairs and the big co-chairs. I'd appreciate when you come back for your more detailed presentation. Are you doing anything to look at cost savings or efficiencies of operations? We have a goal to come up with $200 million saving, and I don't see that anything that we're talking about here. And I, as a taxpayer, and I think for the citizens, and to help the co-chairs and the big co-chairs, I'd like to see some presentations about efficiencies and savings. Thank you.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I appreciate the request. I think we have done some work, and we'll talk more when we come back as an agency, most especially around how we are allocating resources through our K-12 system around poverty. We just released a report and submitted that to this committee. So I think there are some opportunities for us. That is not a specific charge of our agency, but we certainly have the research capacity to look into those issues.
Thank you.
I had a conversation with Mr. Capps about that very thing last week.
So in terms of sort of some of the commitments and principles that guide our work across city education agencies, obviously, as you see even represented here today, there's a commitment to thinking about a seamless system of education, how efforts and strategies within one sector may impact outcomes and performance in another, our ability to think about the integration or relationship of policy across sectors is critically important. Our focus around educational equity, as I think you'll hear in this presentation today, how we are both targeting policies and resource allocation decisions to affect those students who need support the most is an important principle. Multiple pathways of learning. So we talk a lot about this in terms of how we're creating career-connected pathways of learning, career technical education, our STEM education opportunities, but also things like dual credit and how we're creating college coursework opportunities for students in high school. Two other important pieces, I think, are around how do we build system capacity across our sectors. We work a lot to think about what are the support systems that students need to be successful. We talked a little while ago about chronic absenteeism. What are the ways in which we can help organize a statewide response to address the holistic needs of students in attending a school regularly? But there are also other opportunities as well. To think about the way in which we work with within the K-12 system, 197 separate jurisdictions, 17 community colleges, 7 public universities. What are some ways that the state can be investing in providing systems that help to link those entities together? Longitudinal data is one example of that. Other areas of opportunity are a place that we're working in terms of linking practice and effective strategies together. Our education workforce, pre-kindergarten through grade 12, has been a particular area of focus. Not only in improving supports and trying to establish a more diverse education workforce, but thinking about how we are aligning our efforts to support those educators between the pre-K and K-12 system. And then lastly, our ability to align outcomes, standards, and practices. So thinking about ways that if we're focused on the transitions that students are making across the system, across that learning continuum, how are we ensuring that there are not barriers that exist for students that come from different ways of measuring or supporting those systems, those students across the system. And lastly, research. We bring together a cross-agency research team representative of all state agencies. And I think one of the things that we're looking forward for the future is how might we expand that network to engage our post-secondary institutions and others. We'll talk with you today a little bit about some of the key areas programmatically that we're focused on. Certainly, as we think about achieving the 40-40-20 goals, and importantly, ensuring every student is graduating high school, a key piece of that is really our investment in early learning programs. David mentioned the suite of those that he is working to support in his role. But we see the investments that have been made by the legislature in high-quality preschool, childcare, and full-day kindergarten as really important steps in ensuring that we are delivering students to school ready for kindergarten. We have work to do around chronic absenteeism, as we've talked about, and youth re-engagement to address dropout rates. Work specifically focused through our education innovation officer around connecting with communities and schools around specific strategies to improve high school graduation outcomes. Work underway that we have engaged with both the K-12 and secondary level as well as our post-secondary partners in providing transition supports for those who are accessing, for example, the Oregon Promise. Continued work around our educator workforce and supports there that engage both early learning and K-12 and our Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and again, ongoing development of our longitudinal data system. So I want to just talk briefly about our commitment to equity. We have all adopted the state's equity lens. And have a shared commitment to examining really all policies, proposed resource allocation decisions, and other policy making choices to ensure that this is consistent with our values as a state and as an education system. Up on the screen, you'll see a couple of key belief statements that I think are indicative of what the equity lens is about. First and foremost, it's about making resource allocation decisions that are going to affect student outcomes for those students most in need. But it also reflects the fact that our system must become more culturally competent and responsive in order to meet the needs of those students. It recognizes that, very consistent with the charge of the Chief Education Office, that we need to be working with communities and parents and teachers and others that can help inform our policy decisions, and importantly, reflect the context in which those policy decisions are being implemented. That's an important step, not only to make sure that those communities and partners are being heard, but ensuring that those policies are going to be effective. And it certainly has as an ultimate goal the opportunity to end disparities and gaps in both achievement and opportunity. So I'll turn it over to our Deputy Superintendent to talk a little bit more about how the equity lens is being put into action through some of our statewide equity plans.
Dr. Norm.
Thank you, Lindsay. I think if I were to go back to the previous slide, no, you don't need to, David, but metaphorically speaking, it says commitment to equity, and I believe what you have on this slide are examples of our state's commitment to equity with leadership and support from the legislature. So as we think about equity, we think about it in relationship to the student groups that we discussed earlier. Who's graduating from high school? Who's completing in 4 years? Who needs more time to complete high school? We also looked at the data that Ben presented from higher education. Who are the students that are actually enrolling in higher education? Do we see gaps? Absolutely, there are tremendous gaps that cause us to pause and think about why don't we have more students from the different student groups enrolling in college and most importantly, completing college. So this is an investment on our part as a state. And again, I say it was led and supported by the legislature, and some of you that have championed these efforts are here. So they're designed to address specifically the issues we've been discussing, chronic absenteeism, the graduation rate and to change the numbers of students that enroll and complete higher education. And this is really a state commitment, and it's something that we're very excited about. House Bill 3499, which we're folding into our state EL plan, English Language Learners Plan, currently is being implemented in 40 districts, and that supports over 24,000 students. Mm-hmm. And we believe that these investments are systems investments. Yes, they are targeting our English learners, but as we improve the systems of instruction, the systems of delivery, that will benefit all students in our schools and districts. Our African American Student Success Plan involves four grantees that represent the majority of African American black students in the state of Oregon. Yes, it is a concentration in the Portland area. However, they are serving students that will benefit tremendously in terms of attendance, engagement, the family's role in relationship to education, completing high school, and enrolling in high school. In fact, we have data that suggests that if our African American students go directly to college right after high school, they are most likely to complete college compared to the rest of their peers. So that is a tremendous investment that will pay huge dividends in the long term. Our tribal attendance project is really focused, it's part of our American Indian Alaska Native statewide plan that we, with the Chief Ed Office and our partner organizations here, engage tribal communities on a regular basis to serve their needs. The plan is a state plan, but it's designed to be customized and tailored to meet the needs of the communities and the students that live in those communities and participate in the school districts in those communities. But the Tribal Attendance Project is really focused on attendance. It's focused on addressing the chronic absenteeism issues that we find specifically in our Native American community. We had the individuals that manage those projects at the department last week, and they were giving us an update. And every update they provided had real life stories. They had pictures of kids, and we see a dramatic change in attendance just within the last 5 months of participation in this program, some anywhere from 45% attendance to 95% attendance, an increase in attendance from 78% to 95%. And what that really entails is creating awareness on the part of the family more than anything, and the students, but it's also spilling into the community to help them understand the importance of attendance. So our project coordinators are ones that community members now call when they see kids not in school. Families are being engaged, and families are actually navigating the system now in a more intentional and deliberate way, and they value attendance because they realize that if their kids are not in school, their kids are not learning. And they're also developing a habit of not being in school, and that means they're going to fall behind. They're going to fall behind in their learning and their academics and their credits, and they're not going to graduate. So these are tremendous investments on the part of our state that are not huge in many respects, but I think the return on the investment will be significant.
Well, Dr. Knorr, one investment that we made a few years ago was for all full-day kindergarten for all of our students. That was a big battle. I fought it for years to try and finally get that implemented, and several others, legislators did as well, because we had evidence that students that had full-day kindergarten versus the half-day program succeeded to a much greater extent, learned the skills they needed. So I'm hoping that you are tracking those students now that have had full-day kindergarten, and what some of those that at the beginning would be about third grade now. Tracking to see what the real difference is, because there was criticism that this was just another unfunded mandate. And I fought that criticism because I believed that full-day kindergarten would lead to a success as they get to third grade and to middle school and on to adulthood. So I hope you're tracking carefully what the success rate of these various demographics is that have had full-day kindergarten versus those prior that didn't have full-day kindergarten.
Co-Chair Monroe, thank you so much for the question and the comment. And we are prepared to talk about kindergarten later on in the presentation, but you're absolutely correct. Thank you for your leadership in that regard. And we do have nearly 50,000 students that are actually participated in full-day kinder compared to previous biennium. And we will be happy to provide data once it's available.
Good. Yeah. Representative Parrish?
Thank you. So I mean, I support this work, but I'm struggling to sort of wrap my head around the fact that we have one of the smallest African-American black student populations in the nation, yet we have one of the worst graduation rates in the nation for such a small population. And the achievement gap between African-American kids and their white peers is one of the larger gaps in the nation. And so when you've only got less than 14,000 African-American kids in the state compared to 576,000 kiddos, how are we failing this group? I mean, we keep talking about this, and the numbers aren't getting any better. We've made some additional investments, but the data is showing that we're not making improvements. And to me, it's pretty frustrating to see that, you know, this continues to be a population of kids that disproportionately wind up in our justice system, in our, you know, foster care system, in our social service system. And yet, again, we have, like, one of the smallest populations in the nation and one of the worst graduation rates for them. And I'm struggling to wrap my head around how we solve that or why aren't we solving it. Now, I have some theories on this, and I will be happy to share them at another time, but I would like to hear, you know, where your thoughts are on why we're not making this.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, I think your comments really amplify the challenge that we have, and you're absolutely right. It's a small yet significant number of our student population, and the strategies that we have taken in the past perhaps have not worked. What we are learning is that you have to mitigate some of the barriers that keep students from engaging in school in an effective way, and the families. So our work on chronic absenteeism, our work that you're going to hear about here shortly relative to trauma-informed practices, our work relative to the variables that keep certain groups of students from graduating from high school, which needs to be analyzed, needs to be unpacked, will help address some of those issues. Our African-American student graduation rate increased, I believe, by three and a half percentage points just from last year to this year, which is absolutely dramatic, and it's something that we celebrate and are happy about. I believe we also learned that communities must be involved in these conversations. When you look at the work that's happened in Portland at Jefferson in particular with Self Enhancement Inc., which is a community-based organization that supports students, African-American students specifically, in our academic achievement and success, that is a model that we should pay attention to. So it's not always the school that has all the answers or all of the solutions. These happen in partnership with community-based organizations. The four grantees that we have under the African-American Black Student Success Plan will provide us some very effective examples and strategies of how to overcome those barriers. So I think we were trying to focus exclusively on the academic needs of the students, but their needs are much greater than that. We have to look at the family needs, we have to look at the social-emotional needs of students and the supports that need to be in place and how we engage the community in that process. And that is new learning for all of us, I would say.
Follow up.
How much are you doing to go and, you know, bring best practices for others from other states? I mean, that,
yes.
You know, when I look at, so I've got a nephew who's black, mm-hmm. and they live in Tennessee, mm-hmm. and his odds are much higher as a black student that he's going to graduate than he would if he lived here in Oregon. His,
yep.
You know, my sister's from Oregon, right? And so his opportunity is much higher elsewhere where they're currently living. And I couldn't encourage them to come back to Oregon right now, even if I wanted to. And so what are you doing to look at other states' best practices and bring that home without us? Oregon likes to invent lots of wheels, and they don't always work. So I would, you know, prefer that we're reaching into other states who are being really successful and asking them, what are you doing to...
Right.
drive your numbers up almost 20 points higher mm-hmm. for this population of students than Oregon is.
Yeah, yeah. Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, you're absolutely right. We are looking at other states. So our statewide advisory committee on the African American Black Student Success Plan broke up into four groups, and they're looking at every segment from early learning, elementary, middle, secondary, and then post-secondary. And some of the things that we assisted them with is looking at what other states are doing, looking at best practices that we can adopt here in our state. One of the key best practices is, are two, I would say. One is the culturally responsive teaching, if you will, training all of our teachers in the state of Oregon, and specifically teachers where we have a concentration of diversified student populations, on culturally responsive pedagogy, culturally responsive instruction. So they understand that the students and families, although have different experiences, different backgrounds, those are assets that can be incorporated into the learning process for the student. And changing the way we deliver instruction and organize instruction, because students have different needs. They have different learning styles, different goals, different backgrounds. So those are all best practices that we're gleaning from other states. And I totally agree. That is something we're learning from.
One last follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So on the grant money from 2016, $2.8 million, so you're issuing these to schools. What is your accountability metric that makes sure that those dollars were delivered to where they needed to go and they didn't just get sucked into some school district's, you know, general fund? And I mean, is there actually like a, we spent the money here and here's the outcomes, and you're getting that data back from school districts where you've made that, those grants?
Co-chair, it's Monroe Smith Warner, Representative Parrish. The grants actually went to community-based organizations that had to establish a partnership with a school district or a number of school districts. So it's almost a consortium-like approach. The funding went to Self Enhancement Inc., for example, as one of those grantees. They submit a plan, they submit a budget, we approve it, we provide technical assistance and monitoring relative to how they're spending those resources, and then we have specific metrics associated with every great span of the continuum, if you will. So the committee has done a tremendous job in terms of mapping this out, and they actually have a state plan. So it's not just four grantees that we're monitoring. This is a statewide plan to improve the outcomes for African American Black students. So we engage on a regular basis. We do visits, and we were there to also provide support. So it's not just monitoring. This is a partnership because we want to learn from it so we can disseminate those practices to other regions around the state.
Senator Robles.
And thank you for that. And just a little bit along that, because that particular grant was a frustration to our district because all of the grantees were in the metropolitan Portland area as opposed to ones that had tried consortiums in the Eugene area. And so it was a frustration. I continue to watch very closely on how they're going to distribute this to these other more rural areas. So I look forward to that. So thanks.
I'm interested because the African American community used to be almost exclusively in Portland School District Number 1, but gentrification now has moved a lot of those families east into David Douglas and Park Rose and Reynolds, and it'll be interesting to see whether those suburban-ish school districts are having better success than Portland School District Number 1 has had with that community. I have my own thinking about it, but Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. I sit on the Reynolds School Board, and we have received an increase of African American students from North Portland. But I think historically it's important to remember and understand that the history of Oregon when it comes to African Americans as an exclusionary state, and where we placed African Americans, particularly in Vanport, and the history around that, and why right now there's such a large concentration of African Americans in the metropolitan area, and why resources need to be specifically directed towards that, in large part because of our own historical initiatives, if you will. But one of the problems still continue to happen in my school district. There is still that gap. There is still the absenteeism gap, the discipline disproportionality. And, you know, there are many reasons for it, I believe, from systemic to housing to the access to pedagogy that gives them agency and self-imaging as well. But I think that we have much work to do if we are to change the current disparities that continue to exist, because every year when I get school improvement plans, that gap exists. Yeah. You know, in large part, too, we do need more teachers who understand how to teach cultural competency, but we also need more teachers that look like the students as well.
Well said. Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, we're within a few minutes of the end of the meeting, and sort of, is this a good place to cut off? And I don't want to get into something and have to revisit it.
Okay. So we will continue with you all tomorrow, and then we'll also be hearing from Iris and some of the other folks. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You took the words right out of my mouth. I was just going to say I know I'm eager to have the input of the Youth Development Council as part of the transitions because that's a very key element, and it even is part of some of the things that have already been talked about by you guys, whether it's the earlier, the high school attainment and graduation rates, all of that. So I'm eager to have that input as part of this conversation tomorrow as well.
Other comments or questions? I've been in this position for 10 years now and in education for over 50 years, and I learn something new every day. So I want to thank you all. Being in the legislature itself is a tremendous educational opportunity. I mean, we end up dealing with stuff that we never even thought about. But especially as a lifelong educator, it's interesting to me that every time I sit through one of these meetings like today, I'm learning something new. So I guess, you know, old dogs can learn new tricks. I want to thank this committee. I really appreciate it, every one of you. And as we move forward with our work, I think we're going to play a key role in helping to solve some of the educational problems in this state. Okay, Madam Co-Chair, we'll be chairing tomorrow, and we look forward to seeing you all, and we're adjourned. And we're adjourned.